Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did the 1960s really begin? An almanac would obviously tell us it was January 1st, 1960, although many people's memories of the spirit of the decade focus on the later years. But my guest today says the real turning point of the 1960s was right in the center, 1965, a year that saw social and political upheaval few Americans would have predicted and dramatically set the historic stage for what was to come within the next few years. James T. Patterson is Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. His new book is called Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What got you thinking about 1965 in particular as such an important year?
Well, in the longer view of things, it stemmed from the fact that for many years at Brown University, I taught courses in 20th century United States history and even into the 21st century. I'm retired now. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, I found myself spending more time in lectures and in classes on the 1960s, which was obviously a very exciting period. And like most historians, I long ago discarded, as you just put it, the notion that the 60s, what we mean and when we think about the 60s, really wasn't 1960 to 1970, nothing is that neat in history, but that the turbulence and rancor and polarization and often the violence, both at home and in Vietnam, that we associate with the 60s really got a head start in 1965. This was not by any means the most tumultuous year. 1968 probably was, and there have been several books written on that. But I think you can't understand 1968 without seeing how much changed in 1965.
You open the book, and this is really fascinating, by taking us back to the December 1964 Christmas tree lighting at the White House. President Johnson made these incredibly positive remarks as if we had finally sort of wrestled all our demons and we were looking ahead to this great, peaceful, and prosperous future. What caused him to be so very optimistic at that moment in time?
You're right. It's a great quotation. I'm not the only one who's used it, in which he actually says these were the most hopeful days for the world since Christ was born in Bethlehem. Mm. And he went on in that direction. I might add, by the way, that others at the same time found nothing over the top, really, in this statement. Johnson was reflecting a widespread view of leading journalists and others in late 64, early 65. Most things were going very well for the United States. The economy had been booming ever since 1961. Consumer goods were pouring out. Color television was just getting started. The nation was at peace. We had something like 16,000 so-called military advisors in Vietnam, but they were not supposed to be in combat, and we didn't say that they were. The civil rights movement was triumphant, having secured a very important Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed Southern-style discrimination and Jim Crow. It was just a very upbeat time. There were some worrisome trends. Vietnam was clearly a troublesome place, and indeed the Gulf of Tonkin episode occurred in August of 1964, which led Johnson, claiming that American destroyers had been fired at, to bomb North Vietnam for a couple of days, but then he posed as a man of peace. There was also a lot of trouble in Mississippi that summer, including the murder of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And there was the Berkeley free speech movement in the late 64. So there were signs of the troubles and changes to come, but they seemed minimal compared to the overall sense of good feeling. And so and also, of course, Johnson won a sweeping victory in his presidential campaign of 1964 against Barry Goldwater. And this brought with him a huge Democrat majority in both houses of Congress. And so he laid out a very ambitious and ultimately mostly successful program of domestic legislation that passed in 1965 and which was known as the Great Society. So for a lot of reasons, he had reasons to be hopeful.
How did Americans view those plans for a Great Society before things took sort of a darker turn throughout the mid to later 60s?
Well, Johnson had very high poll ratings throughout 1965, despite the escalation in the war, which we can talk about. Most of the time, most Americans gave him roughly two-thirds positive ratings as president. They even supported the escalation in Vietnam. In fact, anti-war activity was, while it was growing considerably among students and among radicals, was still relatively small even at the end of 1965. So, and Americans, when they were polled about whether government did the right thing most of the time, three-quarters of them said they did, whereas today it'd be your lucky one-quarter. So the notion that government could and would make things better was a central faith of liberals like Johnson, and Johnson was a liberal, and the liberal majorities in both houses of Congress. So much of this legislation passed with ease. It was a historic voting rights bill, which is still important in our system. There was Medicare, Medicaid, National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities, first time the government ever approved large-scale public aid to public schools, and an expansion of the war on poverty, which had started in late 64. On and on and on, very important pieces of legislation, a sweeping review and reform of our racist immigration system. All of these things passed in 1964. It was the high point of American liberalism in the 20th century.
Let's talk a little bit about that war on poverty, because you mentioned earlier that there was great prosperity, economic inequality was at sort of an all-time low. However, it's really important to take those figures and parse them out according to race, because while things were quite good for the majority of white Americans, it was a very different story for African Americans.
You're absolutely right. And there was every reason for policymakers and others to know this. Although the focus for civil rights legislation was on the South, the poverty there was enormous, but it was also widespread in the cities. Black poverty then and now was normally around three times as high among blacks as among whites. And unemployment then and now was a little more than two times as high among blacks and whites. And these percentage in these percentage differences, although in the actual absolute percentages, these have been discouragingly stable relationships. And yes, this was a real problem, and the war on poverty was supposed to do something about it.
And you also had, more than a decade after Brown versus Board of Education, just a tiny fraction of Southern public schools had been racially integrated.
Yes, I can see you've read my book with care. Thank you.
Sure.
In the Deep South, roughly 1% of Southern black children were going to school with whites in 1964, 10 years after Brown versus Board. It was only in 1964 and in subsequent decisions throughout the later 60s by the Supreme Court that added teeth were called for by the federal courts and the Supreme Court to enforce desegregation of Southern schools. And by the early 70s, a fair amount of progress in that direction had been made. But in 1964-65, it was just getting started.
Was the idea, Jim, among Southern whites that, okay, the federal government may have passed, there may have been the Supreme Court ruling, but we don't really have to do anything until they force us?
That's right. The Brown versus Board of Education in 54, of course, which was unanimous, which is rare nowadays, said that the mandated segregation, school segregation in the South, it did not apply to the non-mandated school segregation, which was by de facto instead of by law in the North. But in the South, this was supposed to be done. But the Supreme Court doesn't have an army. And when it set about in 1955, the year after Brown versus Board, and issued so-called Brown Number 2, a follow-up, it said that the desegregation should take place with all deliberate speed. No doubt you've heard of that phrase. Mm-hmm. Deliberate means take your time. Speed means hurry up. It was ambiguous and unclear and unenforced.
So as the civil rights movement began to take shape, particularly in the South, talk about the methods before 1965 and how unified that movement was.
The civil rights movement began its strongly activist stage in 1960 with the spread of the sit-ins throughout the South. And these continued throughout the early 60s in various places, and sometimes in the North as well, where they were trying to desegregate lunch counters and various other public facilities. There were freedom rides in 1961. There were important demonstrations, such as the one at Birmingham in 1963, led by Martin Luther King. There was the Freedom Summer, which I've mentioned, in Mississippi in 1964, which aimed at promoting so-called freedom schools for blacks, as well as to challenge the all-white Democratic Party in Mississippi. So there was a rising militancy of the civil rights movement in early 1964, which had come to believe that the courts simply could not be relied upon to do the job. You had to do it with your own efforts. And this had some signal successes, notably the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which I just mentioned, and the Voting Rights Act, which took place in 1965, after the early 65 demonstrations in Selma, Alabama, which led to bloodshed, all of it on television, and created a huge move for that piece of legislation, which until then was in doubt. There's a rising militancy. It's overwhelmingly nonviolent in its beliefs and its practice. It was interracial in its leadership, whites as well as blacks cooperating. But by 1965, both of these basic tenets of the movement, interracial leadership and nonviolence, were coming under question on the part of the more militant younger blacks, such as those in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality. The younger, mostly younger leaders of these organizations were impatient with white leadership. They found a lot of it paternalistic. It was their movement, after all. And so you do get, in 1965, a rising tension within the movement. And in Selma, for instance, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, led by Martin Luther King, was leading the effort in 65. And the people from SNCC, SNCC, off and on, refused to join him. So you do have signs of disruption within the movement. And nonetheless, the Selma demonstrations do succeed, again, showing this violence on television, in forcing Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But 5 days later, after it passes, beginning on August 11th, you had this huge riot or demonstration, depending on what you want to call it, in Watts area of Los Angeles.
Let me jump in here, Jim. We need to take a quick break. Yeah. We will talk about this in a moment. My guest is James T. Patterson. He's Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of the new book, Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Western world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
That is Barry McGuire singing his 1965 single, Eve of Destruction. That's also the title of my guest's new book. It's called Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. James T. Patterson is with us to talk about it. He's Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. If you'd like to talk to us, ask a question, or remind us of your memories of this seminal year in modern American history, we invite you to call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jim, you mentioned before the break that literally 5 days after there was the signing of this absolutely historic thing, the Voting Rights Act, the Watts riots broke out in Los Angeles.
That's right. It came as a huge surprise, not only to Johnson and the people who supported and voted for the law in Capitol Hill, but also most of the civil rights leaders themselves, Martin Luther King and Bayard Rustin and various others, admitted that they had simply not known how angry the sentiments of urban blacks were. So what they then have to do is to catch up, so to speak, with the movement, and they become even more militant, some of them, than they previously had been. Meanwhile, of course, whites are absolutely staggered by the extent of the demonstrations and the riots, which lasted 5 days and killed 34 people and caused millions of dollars worth of damage. So you get whites saying, gee, we thought we were supporting a movement which was Christ-like in its nonviolent focus and limited or the major problems being in the South. Now we're realizing, gee, it's much, much broader than that, and these people are violent, and they don't trust white people, and where are we going from here? So that on the one hand, much of the leadership of the black civil rights cause is moving away from nonviolence. Martin Luther King is not. He's still devoted to it. But others are moving away from a necessary commitment to nonviolence in all situations, and they're even more rapidly and more systematically moving away from the acceptance of white leadership. So by mid and late 1965, you get talk of black power and the essential removal of whites from any positions of leadership in both CORE and SNCC. One result of that is they lose all the white money they've been getting and virtually disappear, in the case of SNCC, from the scene. So it's a dramatic change in the nature of the civil rights movement and a dramatic lessening of certainty on the part even of those liberal white people who had supported it. So it's a historic change that takes place here in 1965. First Selma, and now Watts.
And of course, Jim, there had been racial tension in a lot of large U.S. cities outside the Deep South as a result of African-American migration in the Great Migration into places that had historically been full of European Americans. Was it that Americans who were moving out of the cities simply weren't paying attention until all of this was suddenly on live TV every night?
I think they weren't paying as much attention as they should have. You're quite right. In 1964, for instance, there had been a series of riots in northern cities, notably in Harlem, and there had been very serious riots earlier in World War II and right after World War I. But as I say, the focus was really upon the South, and many, many northern white people just sort of assumed that that's where the real problems were, and they didn't pay nearly enough attention, as I say, neither did many of the black leaders, to what was going on in the cities. And in retrospect, it's clear that they should have paid more attention.
So what was the effect of the sort of schism between black leaders who were involved in the civil rights movement, those who wanted to stay committed to nonviolence, and those who said any means necessary are appropriate?
Well, by all means, the majority of black leaders continued to prefer nonviolence and didn't advocate violence. Someone, for instance, like Malcolm X, who was assassinated in February of 1965, but who becomes famous later in the year as a result of the publication posthumously of his autobiography of Malcolm X, they weren't necessarily advocating violence, but they certainly were advocating self-defense, and they were advocating no cooperation between black and whites. Malcolm X, for instance, was not really part of the civil rights movement. He was a black nationalist. Now, not too many blacks went that far, and even fewer bought into the Muslim religion. But there were a lot who were moving in the direction of black is proud, black power, don't depend upon whitey. And so the interracial cooperation weakens. It doesn't disappear, but it weakens.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. The Eve of Destruction piece that you played at the beginning of the show, and then Tin Soldiers and Nixon's Coming, kind of illustrate the impact of music on the outcome of the war. And I wondered what your guest thought was the mechanism of control of the government over the media, and specifically recording industry. And what I mean is when the Iraq War, the first one, and even the second one occurred, there was a notable dearth, lack of protest music on the radio. And so I wonder how that mechanism of control over the recording industry and what's published on the radio is affected.
Well, you know, I have to admit that's not something I deal with in the book, and I don't know much about. It is true in 1965, and this what happens in the field of popular music is something I talk about a good deal in the book. Beginning with I Can't Get No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones, and Bob Dylan going electric at the Newport Folk Festival in the summer. And then, as you know, the song The Eve of Destruction. And you have, by the end of 65, not only The Eve of Destruction as a number one hit earlier in the year, but also Joan Baez and Phil Ochs and other people singing anti-war songs, and you get a considerable change. At the very end of the year, there's Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. But I'm not aware of any effort, at least no systematic effort, by the federal government or state governments or municipalities or anybody else to suppress this music. It came out, and as I say, yeah, some of them were number one hits.
Talk about this, though. Before 1965, there were still very strict codes in the motion picture industry and certainly in the broadcast television industry that governed, for example, any reference to sexuality and any reference to interracial relationships, things like that.
Yeah, Hollywood had what's known as the Motion Picture Production Code, which had been enforced since the early 1930s, which was draconian and was very strict in its censorship of anything openly sexual. Not so strong against violence, but that's always been the case. This was still enforced in 1965. If you look at the various forms of popular culture, let's say music, film, radio, and TV, music is far and away the quickest to respond to social and political change, because it can be produced overnight and be sent out over the air. Television, the major primetime shows are slotted usually for the fall season and last a year, and they're very slow to change. And motion pictures can take several years between the germ of an idea and the actual production. So it's not until 1967 that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate break with these conventions, and by 1969, the production code is history, and American films enter into a what many people think is its golden age of the 1970s, in which there's a far more open depiction of sex and many violent movies. But in 1965, you cannot look at movies and television and see 1965 as an eve of destruction. It was an eve of destruction or an eve of change in a lot of other ways, but not in every way.
It is remarkable to think of 65 as a year when the likes of Frank Sinatra and the Rolling Stones were sort of in competition for major awards and for record sales.
Yes, yes. And the other popular groups, the Beatles, the Supremes, Beach Boys, they were all very popular. Barbara Streisand in 1965. And none of these people was singing topical songs about the war or civil rights. And the beat tended to be fairly bouncy and not loud and frightening, if that's to be said about some of this music. So yes, that's why a song like "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," which probably sounds fairly mild today, was a real shocker when it came out in June of 1965 and was number one on the pop charts for almost a month.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with James T. Patterson about his new book, Eve of Destruction. Let's go next on the phone to Bob, calling from Allen. Hello, Bob.
Hi there. Just one comment about it. You have to also look at the Smothers Brothers during that time and what happened to them in media. But my real comment is all of this Eve of Destruction in 65... wasn't it really caused by the upheaval that happened in World War II and some of the benefits as well as some of the negatives that came out of, say, Rosie the Riveter or the desegregation of the armed forces? Both of them empowered different groups to look for the rights that they should have been bestowed upon them, and the scare that the political powers had during the 1950s that there were changes coming, and they did not want those changes to be implemented.
Yeah, that's a very thoughtful comment. When I used to teach, I'm retired now, I would give some lectures and some classes on the 1950s. And talked about what I called, others had called, kind of a subterranean culture, which consisted as of many of the kinds of things you're talking about, a hostility to McCarthyism, for instance, a support of civil rights, and you can see that in Brown versus Board of Education and the Little Rock crisis, and some women protesting against they're being put down by the system. But I nonetheless believe that the dominant cultural and political nature of America in the 1950s was what a lot of people say it was. That is to say, a fairly conservative time, not necessarily the nifty 50s, as some people think, but a time when these movements, feminism, civil rights, topical music and so forth, they really are subterranean and scarcely noticed and of no political impact at all, with the exception of Brown versus Board and a few other things, which, as I mentioned before, wasn't enforced. So I think it's really not until the early 60s that you begin to see some significant challenges to this world. And in 1965, when it really comes out. And the one thing I haven't mentioned at all yet, and will now, is it's 1965 is the year when we finally escalate the war.
Yeah.
And January 65, there were 23,000 Americans, military men in Vietnam, South Vietnam, and they were referred to as military advisors. By the end of the year, we're in combat, we're bombing around the clock, we're using napalm, we're getting killed. There's 184,000 American troops in South Vietnam, and at the end of 66, there's 400,000. So it's a dramatic change in our Vietnam commitment, in very much the same way that Selma and Watts bring about a major change in civil rights activism.
And one thing that's important to remember is that Americans didn't have a great deal of experience with looking at a war and saying, we disapprove of this thing that the federal government has done. This was not something Americans of that generation had been raised to do.
That's right. There was an attitude of triumphalism, of course, following World War II, rightly so. And since generally throughout the 40s and 50s, the United States was the strongest nation in the world, and it was the leader of the so-called free world in a Cold War battle with the Soviet Union. And so anti-war feelings, well, they were there, of course. Who wants to go to war? But it was also a very militant anti-communism. And Kennedy and Johnson, for instance, were as much a part of this this approach to the world as Eisenhower and Truman had been.
Mm-hmm. And yet you have this, you know, the first, literally the first generation or the first year of baby boomers were coming of age at this time and recognizing that this was something that they couldn't help but question.
That's right. And you cannot really understand the turbulence that develops on the campuses in the late 60s without understanding that. It's huge numbers going into colleges and universities, and very large numbers of people on college campuses. You only needed a fairly small minority of radical or anti-war students to develop a pretty good-sized crowd.
James T. Patterson is with us. He's Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of the new book, Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. That was another verse from Barry McGuire's 1965 single, Eve of Destruction. My guest is James T. Patterson, Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of the new book, Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Jim, we know that the song was a hit on the pop charts, but can you talk about the sort of overall reaction to this piece of music that sounded like very little else that had come before it and was distinctly just furious about the state of the country?
Yes, well, some people thought it was unpatriotic and, you know, should be banned from the air and that it was poisoning the minds of young people. But and some stations, in fact, then did not play it if they were run by conservative station runners. But it was, as you mentioned, not only a number one hit for a week in September, but had a long run. I mean, it came out in August and moved up pretty close to number one. And after it left the top spot, remained a very, very, very often played song on the radio. right through the end of 1965 and early 1966. Most people I talked to who were young enough at that time, I mean old enough at that time to listen to this music, remember it very well. And it's not, I think, by any means a great piece of music, or it is very simplistic in its politics, but it packed a punch, and it was the first topical song, anti-war, anti-nuclear, anti-racism. It mentions Selma, for instance, mm-hmm. to hit the top.
Where do you come down on this question of whether or not art reflects life or life reflects art? I mean, did music like that really change the way young Americans thought about themselves and their place in the world?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of people who write about anti-war music and so forth, which really becomes much bigger in the late 60s, believe that mostly people who listened and liked that music liked it because they confirmed opinions they either already held very strongly or were sympathetic to. And that is to say, it doesn't make radicals or anti-war people out of people who weren't already there. That's sort of how I would answer the question. The fact that some of these songs become very popular is an indication of growing anti-war and anti-racism feeling, particularly among the young people who like the music. And probably you could not say that the music caused them to be that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Jan in Oak Cliff. Hi, Jan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a comment and a question. The first comment is talking about the music. I think your guest is overlooking the emergence of the FM radio stations at that time. They weren't the same as Johnny Rabbit AM stations. Then my comment is, I grew up in Collinsville, Illinois. It was a small town that was about 15 miles across the river from St. Louis. I grew up in a very democratic family. My father worked at the Sears store in East St. Louis, Illinois. My maternal grandfather, they lived in East St. Louis. I remember going to their house and hearing my dad talk, and I never thought my dad was a racist. We lived a few blocks from the black area of our town, which was derisively called Blank Holler. But East St. Louis in the 1960s went from a fairly comfortable upper middle class lifestyle, predominantly white, to what became a almost 100% lower class, poor, black neighborhood that you drove around. When my father retired from Sears in 1971, he couldn't wait to get out of East St. Louis. Can your guest talk to why that demographic change occurred in that city?
No, I can't. I don't know anything nearly as much as obviously you do about the particular causes of what went on in East St. Louis. Presumably you know all about the Pruitt-Igoe public housing projects there, which ultimately had to be torn down because there was so much violence and disorder in the neighborhood, and it was blamed to some degree upon the housing, which is a simplistic way of looking at it. Most northern and many western cities, and cities like St. Louis, who were, you could call them northern, you could call them southern, of course, had enormous growth in the black population stemming from the mass migration from the South, which began in earnest first in World War I and then again in World War II, and continued after World War II right into the late 60s and early 70s, when for the most part it stopped, and we've had some reverse migration since then. And this transformed a whole lot of cities and created very large black populations in some of them, so that when you had a riot, as you did in Detroit or Newark or Watts in the late 60s, you had hundreds of thousands of people who were available to join in these demonstrations or not join them, as the case may be. You have today, for instance, in Chicago, something like 90% of the public school children in Chicago were black children. And in Detroit, same thing. A black or Hispanic in Chicago and Detroit, where aren't so many Hispanics, 90% black. I mean, this is what happened in many, 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 many northern cities.
Can you talk a little bit about LBJ? I mean, he had so much experience in Congress before he was named to the Kennedy ticket and then ultimately became president himself in 1963. He had great skill in sort of getting what he wanted from Congress, but there were limits to that and to his political influence as the years went on.
He was an absolute genius at manipulating Congress, and a lot of people have contrasted Obama unfairly, I think, to Johnson, because Johnson could get so much out of a Democratic Congress, and Obama, some people argue, can't. They forget, of course, that half of the American Congress isn't Democratic, or hasn't been since 2008. He worked at it all day and well into the night, every single day. He was on top of even the littlest kinds of developments in congressional committees. He had some expert people working for him. He cared deeply about these programs, and he worked night and day to get them through. He would not have succeeded in doing these things if he did not have heavily Democratic Congresses to begin with. This goes without saying. But he got absolute most out of them, and I don't think there's been any president in American history who comes close to his stature as a magical leader of Congress.
There are, of course, also a lot of scholars who point to the fact that the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act ultimately would be the catalyst for the shifts in both the Republican and the Democratic parties, so that there weren't liberal and conservative factions in each party, but in fact the two really separated out. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I absolutely do. I'm glad you pointed it out. Johnson knew this himself when he signed, many books have written this, when he signed the 64 Civil Rights Act, he turned to a number of advisors. Various books have reported the quote a little bit differently, but in effect he said, "We've just turned the South over to the Republican Party, and it's going to happen in my lifetime." Hmm. And it didn't go quite that bad. There are still some Democrats can get elected in the South, but it certainly deeply weakened the Democratic Party, which had dominated the South up until 1964, 65. And it was never the same after that. So that since then you have a Democratic Party which is much more northern and liberal with very few conservatives in it, and a Republican Party which is much more southern and western with very few liberals in it. So the polarization is far greater than it was in 1965, and far greater than it's with all of the problems that you can see today. This has been a tremendous change since 1965, and racial politics were the reason.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ed on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Good afternoon. I grew up I'm living in Dallas now, but I grew up in New York and in New Jersey, and in the 60s I got involved with the civil rights movement. In fact, I was chairman of a county corps there. And one of the things that kind of made this happen in 65, he's right. We were right in the middle of it. All the effort down south was sort of okay. Now they got the vote. Now they got the civil rights bill passed. We looked at it ourselves, and our white counterparts said, "Okay, the job is done. We're going after the Vietnam War." And we looked around, and we still had issues: employment, segregation in the North, and things like that. And so we ended up kind of looking at ourselves. Okay, it's us now. I can't get involved with the Vietnam War thing because I got a battle ahead of us, both in the South and the North. And the people, around me in New Jersey, the whites among us, said, "Well, we're not going to pick this bank or that because of their policies. That's something for you to do." And so, to some extent, we were there by ourselves, and then it became we kind of hunkered down, and the groups, we were a lot smaller, and we ended up being a lot tougher, and we decided to go after things that were meaningful to us as opposed to down south.
That's a really interesting perspective. What do you think about all that, Jim?
It sounds true to me. I mean, as I said before, Many civil rights activists, including many of the black leaders, were either themselves Southern or were concerned with the more blatant racism that had a long history in the South, and were not paying nearly as much attention to what was going on in the North as they should have. And as you mentioned before, and as I mentioned before, you had unrest in Harlem and Rochester, New York, and various other places, and New Jersey again. We had this man's from New Jersey. Same thing, Elizabeth, New Jersey, and Newark, places like that. It was in 1965 that you really begin to see this clearly with the Watts riot, and you see it later with, again, in New Jersey, the Newark riot of 1967, the Detroit riot 67, riots in Philadelphia, riots in Chicago, all over the place.
I'm curious about your perspective as a historian as to how long it really takes to have perspective on what one is living through. I would imagine that in 1965 things felt very different to some people, but maybe not so much that someone in that year could have said, in 2013 there will be a book out about this year in particular.
Well, you ask very good questions. I've written in a number of books on late 20th century history. Various of my colleagues at Brown University and in the historical profession say that isn't history. You need much more time to look back. But there's a lot of people who've been writing very recent history or so-called contemporary history, and it changes. There is no. You often hear the word definitive. This is the definitive history of something. There's no such thing. The different historians at different viewpoints, and the time in which a book is written makes a huge difference, because you cannot put out of your mind things that are happening today as you write about the past. So somebody writing about 1965 and 1967 would not have been able to write my book. They wouldn't see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some people who read my book now wouldn't see it that way. That's life.
So you're comfortable with that. I think it's great that someone might write about 1965 in 2065, and it will be a different book once again.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because there'd be so many things that could have happened then. They would say, well, 1965 may have been important, but look what happened in 2126.
James T. Patterson is Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. His new book is called Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. Jim, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, too. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.